This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Eric Saar, witnessed the use of sexual interrogation tactics at the detention facility for suspected terrorists in Guantanamo Bay, often referred to as Gitmo, which was opened in January of 2002. Saar worked as an Arabic translator at Guantanamo for 6.5 months, beginning in December of 2002. His first job there was translating the detainees' day-to-day communications with the guards and military personnel. Then he translated interrogations and intelligence documents. He's written a new book about what he witnessed at Guantanamo called Inside the Wire. Also joining us is Saar's co-author Vivica Novak, a Washington correspondent for Time magazine who covers legal affairs, terrorism, and civil liberties. Saar asked her to collaborate with him after reading a story she'd written on Guantanamo. Well, Eric Saar, let's start with what is probably the most extreme example of interrogation in your book. And this was you were translating for a Saudi prisoner who was being interrogated by a woman in the American military. What was the goal of this interrogation? What kind of information were they looking for from this prisoner?
Terry, this was a prisoner that was uncooperative in the past, but as the intelligence team had been confronted with information regarding this individual, that made us believe that he had connections to terrorism, and he had been uncooperative for a long period of time since he'd been confronted with that information. And that evening, the intent of this interrogation was to humiliate this detainee and to create a barrier through sexual humiliation and sexual enticement between the detainee and his faith and his religion, because the interrogator believed that this individual was returning to his cell and somehow gaining strength from his personal relationship with his religion and with his faith. And the intent was to create a wedge or a divide between the detainee and that relationship. In one instance, wiping red ink on the detainee's face, which he believed was menstrual blood, in an attempt to make him feel as though he was unclean. So according to the interrogator's beliefs regarding Islam, that he would then be unable to go back to his cell and pray.
Well, the first thing this interrogator did in terms of sexual humiliation, I mean, he would have interpreted it as sexual humiliation. She rubbed her breasts against him. Would you describe like what she did and what his reaction was?
Yes, ma'am. She was wearing a tight brown T-shirt, and she took off this outer top and was trying to tempt him, and turned around and rubbed her chest on his back. The idea was that because he was going to be attracted to her and aroused by her, she said to him, you know, how do you feel about being attracted to an American infidel? That somehow he was then supposed to have a certain amount of guilt that went along with that feeling, that made him feel as though he wasn't being a true Muslim.
Then she took a break from the interrogation and talked to a translator who was Muslim.
Yes, ma'am.
And developed a different tactic. What was that, and what do you know about what their interaction was like? Were you overhearing them?
I did overhear them, and the question was from her to the Muslim linguist was, what else can I do to create this sort of wedge and make him feel as though he cannot return to his cell and pray? And she was instructed to, or she was given the advice of suggesting, telling the detainee that she was menstruating. So then we went one step further, and when we returned to the interrogation booth, that was when the example of wiping the red ink on the detainee's face and telling him that it was menstrual blood, that's where that occurred.
And what was his reaction to that?
His reaction was violent. He came out of his chains. One of his ankle shackles came loose. He spit at us. He was screaming. And I believe that was, in a way, the reaction that she was looking for.
You say it was this interrogator's goal to create a wedge between this Saudi prisoner and his religion, because she thought he was getting strength and sustenance from his faith. Was it part of policy at Guantanamo to keep people from their faith? Because there's been, we've been told that every effort has been made to let them let the Muslims pray several times a day. The call to prayer is given over the loudspeakers. Every Muslim is given a copy of the Quran to have in the cell with them. I mean, and you know, the Bush administration is so pro-faith. So is this idea of creating a wedge between a prisoner and his faith part of policy?
Well, everything you mentioned, ma'am, is correct, and all of that does exist in the general population. But what I'm referring to are tactics that were used in the interrogation booth with certain detainees that I think normally rose to the level of a pretty significant priority. So that was where, and I do believe that it was a matter of policy to use these techniques. They weren't hidden from anyone. A number of individuals knew that sex was used as a weapon in the interrogation booth to interfere with this relationship. So on one hand, ma'am, there was a concerted effort, and I do think, by and large, as a camp, the camp as a whole attempted to provide an environment where the detainees can practice their faith. And all of the concessions that you mentioned were indeed they were definitely there. I'm not denying that. But the fact that in the interrogation booth we determined that it was appropriate to use these tactics, which I would also add were entirely ineffective. And actually, a number of individuals and a number of professionals on the island outside of the military also complained about these tactics. For example, the recently declassified FBI emails cite that not only are these tactics unethical, but they're ineffective.
So, Terry, the if I could jump in, the there's a passage in the book where Eric, you know, we describe Eric's reaction to this meeting where all the intelligence personnel, the interrogators, and the linguists were called in. And there was a lawyer, a JAG lawyer from Washington, who had come down and had a PowerPoint presentation, and he was explaining to them, you know, why the Geneva Conventions did not apply to these detainees. A very unusual meeting for the Army to hold because, as Eric says, the military doesn't do explainers. They just tell you what's going to happen. And this was kind of the signal that, you know, this was a huge deal for interrogations and the old rules didn't apply. But the problem was nobody knew what the new rules were and nobody had experience with new rules because all Army interrogators are trained, you know, they have it hammered into their heads that they are to abide by the Geneva Conventions. And, you know, I think that's where a lot of the problems started. And even at Abu Ghraib, where conditions were much, much worse, I think, the detainees there were supposed to be covered by the Geneva Conventions. And yet, you know, why did the things happen that happened there? I think it was, you know, because largely because of the confusion that had been sowed by the various directives on the handling of detainees at Gitmo.
Vivica, the story that we just heard about the female interrogator who used her sexuality as a tool in the interrogation, the chapter about that was there was an attempt to remove it from the book when an early draft was submitted to the military, as Eric Saar was required to do. First of all, if you could just explain why he had to submit the book and then just like describe why officials asked for it to be taken out?
Well, the he submitted it, actually, even before we met, he submitted an early version of an account of his memories from Guantanamo. He had signed an agreement, as other soldiers in this world are required to sign, saying he wouldn't reveal classified information. And it isn't always clear what's classified information, so he had submitted this to see what would be allowed. In the end, we got permission to publish, you know, the account of this interrogation. But what happened is that I think early on, and we didn't find this out until later, but early on, the officials down at Guantanamo had wanted to disallow publicizing this anecdote. And in Washington, the office that is responsible for the final sign-off on this kind of thing went back to them and said, "Are you sure that you know you can come up with a good legal reason to prohibit this from being published?" The only reason we know that is that somebody, some disgruntled Pentagon person, I guess, leaked this account, 9 pages of what Eric had submitted, to an AP reporter who in January of this year published the account of this interrogation. And we learned through that the pages she had gotten had a slip of paper attached to it from Pentagon headquarters in Washington, writing to the people at Gitmo saying, are you sure that you have the legal authority to redact this material? And that's when we learned that originally they had not wanted this to be published.
And also, Terry, I'll add that in fairness, I should say that when the Pentagon's version, when they're vetting in their vetting process and determining what is and is not classified, their only mission is to determine what is and is not classified. So they don't concur with they try to make it very clear when they give the document back. In fairness, I should say that they're just saying that this is not classified. They're not saying taking an opinion on the issues per se.
Right. So the fact that they're letting you publish something doesn't necessarily mean that they agree that it happened.
It just means that they don't think they could defend their decision to redact it if they were sued.
Eric Saar, do you care to speculate how high up in the chain people knew about some of the more extreme methods of interrogation at Guantanamo?
Well, Terry, I do know from my colleagues that they had no reason to doubt that individuals very high up the chain of command knew, especially some of the extreme techniques that were being employed, because they have certain measures that they have to take as interrogators to get approval for those techniques. I mean, this isn't something where a junior soldier just walks into an interrogation booth and says, this is the tactic I'm going to use today, and whatever I think looks good, I'm going to kind of freelance, because they have policies and directives that they have to follow, and they know full well that if they choose not to follow those, there are far-reaching ramifications to that decision.
Now, Eric, I want to make clear that you say, this interrogation that you just described, or the interrogator used her sexuality as a tool to try to get the Saudi prisoner to talk, was not typical. And you give an example of a woman interrogator who you thought was really excellent and had a real gift for getting prisoners to speak to her with a degree of comfort. Could you talk about what her technique was?
Yes, ma'am. That was a different government agency that happened to be working on the island, and I do want to be very clear that this was not something that everyone who was at Gitmo participated in, and that were down there on a regular basis abusing prisoners. That's really not what I'm saying. There were elements within our government that disagreed with these tactics, and a civilian agency chose to employ different interrogation methods, and actually they really didn't even refer to them as interrogations. They called them interviews, and they were attempting to build a rapport with the detainee and establish a certain level of trust, whereby they would then be able to get the detainee to at least begin talking. And when that occurs, at least the interviewer or the interrogator has the opportunity to exploit the information being passed to him or her.
Would you describe what her technique was?
Her technique was simply to build rapport with the detainee, to establish a level of trust, to try to find some commonality and understand the culture of where the detainee grew up, to understand his family, his background, and thereby get him to begin to talk to her and then exploit his information.
What are some of the other things you witnessed during interrogations that struck you as extreme techniques in either being overly coercive, overly painful so as to be or to approach torture? Can you describe some of the other things that you think crossed the line?
I could say some of the examples of interrogations I participated in, and then others I knew about through my colleagues who both worked in interrogations and translated interrogations. I could say that in general, in the broad scope of the fear-up approach of where an interrogator was putting a detainee in a stress position, meaning that he was chained to the floor and forced to hunch over and exposed to cold temperatures and exposed to sleep deprivation and things of that nature. I mean, I think that overall, all of these factors or all of these circumstances for me are what created the picture that this was un-American. But maybe for some listening, more importantly, I might want to also point out that these are tactics that were ineffective. I mean, one of the things that was enormously frustrating to me as a soldier and as someone who had some experience in intelligence was that we had a cadre of individuals on the island, including, for example, FBI special agents, who had an enormous amount of experience in the intelligence community and had been working in counterterrorism, some individuals for a decade, because they had been working on counterterrorism since the first World Trade Center bombing. And these were individuals who disagreed with the use of these tactics, saying, look, this doesn't need to be these tactics don't need to be employed, and in fact, they're counterproductive. If in later interrogations we want to go back and somehow try to build a relationship with this detainee, you've now burned that bridge, so we can't do that. So there were a number of factors that really contributed to me reaching the decisions that I made.
There have been reports of a lot of suicide attempts on the part of detainees at Guantanamo. Did you see a lot of suicide attempts while you were there?
I did see the results of a number of suicide attempts. And we responded on the first team that I was on when I dealt with the detainees on a daily basis to suicide attempts fairly regularly, to be honest with you. And when I contrasted what I saw in terms of how many suicide attempts we responded to as linguists to the public affairs information that was coming out of Guantanamo Bay regarding how many actual suicide attempts there were, the numbers definitely didn't match up. And I realized later during my time at Guantanamo Bay that the reason for that was because the Pentagon had determined that a number of these examples that I would term as suicide attempts, they ended up not calling them suicide attempts because they referred to them as something called self-injurious manipulative behavior.
And what does the manipulative mean in self-injurious manipulative behavior? That they're injuring themselves to get attention or to evoke sympathy?
That was the perception to us, that they decided to stop categorizing them as suicide attempts because they believed that the detainees were attempting to manipulate the system. Some of them wanted to go to isolation, they believed. Some of them, they thought, just wanted more attention from the mental health professionals. So they said these weren't valid suicide attempts. They were really attempts where they had no chance whatsoever of really killing themselves. Therefore, they determined that they should label them as something else.
And did you think that there was, at the very least, an element of truth to that?
An element of truth in the sense that some of the attempts were feeble because of the means in which detainees had to use to try to kill themselves. In other words, they were really trying to rig they were trying to hang themselves, and it was very difficult for them to do that. So in terms of the military's argument that they didn't really have a very good chance of actually killing themselves, that might have some credibility. But whether or not they really intended or would have hoped to kill themselves, I don't think is something that the military really could ascertain.
A lot of the prisoners have been sent back to their countries from Guantanamo. What were some of the reasons for releasing them?
I'll answer this, and then maybe Vivica can actually add a little bit, probably based on her background. But I believe, from my experience, I think a number of them were released because we didn't know why they had ever been picked up. And the government has said that they're no longer a threat to the United States. But to be honest with you, as someone who spent time there, I don't know that they were ever a threat to the United States. And I think we had a number of individuals when I was there, even shortly after I joined the intelligence team, and in February of 2003, that we knew, despite the fact that the camp had only been open a little over a year, we already knew that they were individuals that we were going to end up sending back to their home country because we couldn't ascertain that they were picked up on the battlefield, and we didn't know that they actually posed a threat to us, and we found no holes in their story. But I don't know, maybe Vivica could add other reasons why they may have been sent home.
Well, what I found as a reporter kind of following this was, you know, I had various sources who were talking to me off the record from the Pentagon and elsewhere, intelligence sources, who are saying that, you know, a number of these detainees are now on the list, a growing list, of individuals who should be sent back, who we really, you know, don't need to be holding. But they weren't released, and their, you know, releases kept being postponed, and, you know, people started telling me that, you know, it was for political reasons, that it didn't look good to have a big release of you know, 100 detainees. That wouldn't look good for the administration because it would show so dramatically how many were picked up in error. And things were just, you know, they were dragged out and dragged out. And it took, you know, the Supreme Court case that was decided in June of last year for the Pentagon to be forced to give these detainees a chance in federal court to bring their case, to challenge their detentions. And I would also, I wanted to add to something Eric said before about, you know, we've been talking about these different interrogation techniques and the different sorts of things that the detainees were put through. I think we're also losing sight of perhaps the most extreme form of abuse that we put these people through, which was the psychological torture of not knowing your fate. We're keeping these people for years. They never know if they're going to see a lawyer. They didn't know if they were going to be charged with anything. Many of them didn't know why they were there. But just that open-endedness is, I think, very, very tough on the psyche.
I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Eric Saar and Vivica Novak co-authored the new book about Guantanamo, Inside the Wire.